Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. Tomorrow's episode, destroying the anti-deflationists' arguments, is going to be a load of fun. I've been doing a lot of reading on the why deflation is terrible front from a bunch of different things lately, and some of the claims that are just the default, like I just, when I'm hearing sensible, obviously, at least somewhat intelligent people write these absurd claims about what happens in like a bottomless deflationary spiral and all this stuff. And I just think like it's simply because it's the default, is because there's so much propaganda. Really, this only way to describe it is just that we believe this default assumption that just if you stopped and thought about it, just think about it from the case of like, okay, if prices are falling across the economy, what would I do? You realize how hilarious some of their claims, like obviously wrong and extremely limited some of their claims are. I mean, not all of it is, you know, some of it's like very legitimate, like people have concerns that make perfect sense, but some of them are just utterly laughable. But we will continue to set the stage with the amazing work by Halsman. We are continuing from yesterday's episode. So if you did not listen to Quick Read 278, Deflation and Liberty Part 1, we are concluding that piece today. So we are jumping right in the middle and then finishing this piece out. And we are going to have a lengthy follow-up and expansion on these ideas for tomorrow's episode, which I am really excited about, because I think it's just going to be fun tearing this whole argument apart. But with that, let's go ahead and get into it. Let's finish out Deflation and Liberty by Herg Guido Halsman, again made available. Thank you so much to the Mises Institute for publishing this stuff and having it freely available for everyone to read and learn. I truly think that without the Mises Institute, Bitcoin would not be what it is today, because it's been such, I mean, it was a lone resource for Austrian economics in any meaningful sense of like trying to find information and like serious explanations and economic thought on the ideas behind Austrian economics. Like that was it. Like Mises was it for a really long time, and I feel like it's been at the forefront of a multi-decade trend here of growing importance and relevance of the Austrian school. And if this wasn't here as like Bitcoin, like while Bitcoin has been growing, I don't think I don't think without the influence of Mises, Bitcoin would have been the same. I don't think the cypherpunk movement would have had as strong of an economic foundation as many of them did. And also, I don't think that Bitcoin education would have happened as quickly. So that's my little promotional for Mises.org, because I have been using them for a very, very long time, and honestly, I owe them a lot back for what they have made available to me, because genuinely, I wouldn't know any of this stuff without them. It was because I found Mises.org and the Rothbard Rothbard works and Herg Guido Halsman, like all of these people, Hayek. It was really Mises.org that pointed me in this direction when I finally stumbled upon them. So I owe a lot of thanks to that organization, and I just wanted to take a minute and say thank you. All right, so with that, let's go ahead and jump into this piece. Finish out Deflation and Liberty by Herg Guido Halsman. 3. From the standpoint of the commonly shared interests of all members of society, the quantity of money is irrelevant. Any quantity of money provides all the services that indirect exchange can possibly provide, both in the long run and in the short run. This fact is the unshakable starting point for any sound reflection on monetary matters. And it is the most important criterion when it comes to dealing with deflation. In light of the principle discovered by the classical economists, we can say that deflation is certainly not what it is commonly alleged to be, a curse for all members of society. Deflation is a monetary phenomenon, and as such, it does affect the distribution of wealth among the individuals in various strata of society, as well as the relative importance of the different branches of industry. But it does not affect the aggregate wealth of society. Deflation is a drastic reduction of the quantity of money or of money substitutes, and it entails a precipitous decline of money prices. Such an event, be it ever so dramatic for a great number of individuals, is most certainly not a mortal threat for society as a whole. Imagine if all prices were to drop tomorrow by 50%. Would this affect our ability to feed, clothe, shelter, and transport ourselves? It would not, because the disappearance of money is not paralleled by a disappearance of the physical structure of production. In a very dramatic deflation, there is much less money around than there used to be, and thus we cannot sell our products and services at the same money prices as before. But our tools, our machines, the streets, the cars and trucks, our crops and our food supplies, all this is still in place. And thus we can go on producing and even producing profitably, because profit does not depend on the level of money prices at which we sell, but on the difference between the prices at which we sell and the prices at which we buy. In deflation, both sets of prices drop, and as a consequence, for-profit production can go on. There is only one fundamental change that deflation brings about. It radically modifies the structure of ownership. Firms financed per credits go bankrupt because at the lower level of prices, they can no longer pay back the credits they had incurred without anticipating the deflation. Private households with mortgages and other considerable debts to pay back go bankrupt because with the decline of money prices, their monetary income declines too, whereas their debts remain at the nominal level. The very attempt to liquidate assets to pay back debt entails a further reduction of the value of those assets, thus making it even more difficult for them to come even with their creditors. In the memorable words of Irving Fisher, quote, "The more the debtors pay, the more they owe." End quote. Yet from this correct observation, Fisher jumped to the fallacious statement that, quote, "the liquidation defeats itself." Let us emphasize again that bankruptcies, irrespective of how many individuals are involved, do not affect the real wealth of the nation, and in particular, that they do not prevent the successful continuation of production. The point is that other people will run the firms and own the houses, people who at the time the deflation set in were out of debt and had cash in their hands to buy firms and real estate. These new owners can run the firms profitably at the much lower level of selling prices because they bought the stock and will buy the other factors of production at lower prices too. In short, the true crux of deflation is that it does not hide the redistribution going hand in hand with changes in the quantity of money. It entails visible misery for many people to the benefit of equally visible winners. This starkly contrasts with inflation, which creates anonymous winners at the expense of anonymous losers. Both deflation and inflation are, from the point of view we have so far espoused, zero-sum games. But inflation is a secret ripoff, and thus the perfect vehicle for the exploitation of a population through its false elites. Whereas deflation means open redistribution through bankruptcy according to the law. 4. With these statements, we could close our analysis. We have seen that deflation is not inherently bad, and that it is therefore far from being obvious that a wise monetary policy should seek to prevent it, or dampen its effects at any price. Deflation creates a great number of losers, and many of these losers are perfectly innocent people who have just not been wise enough to anticipate the event. But deflation also creates many winners, and it also punishes many political entrepreneurs who had thrived on their intimate connections to those who control the production of fiat money. Deflation is certainly not some sort of a reversal of a previous inflation that repairs the harm done in prior redistributions. It brings about a new round of redistribution that adds to the previous round of inflation-induced redistribution. But it would be an error to infer from this fact that a deflation following a foregoing inflation was somehow harmful from an economic point because it would involve additional redistributions. The point is that any monetary policy has redistributive effects. In particular, once a deflation of the supply of money substitutes sets in, the only way to combat this is through inflation of the supply of base money, and this policy too involves redistribution and thus creates winners and losers. It follows that there is no economic rationale for monetary policy to take up an ardent fight against deflation, rather than letting deflation run its course. Either policy does not benefit the nation as a whole, but merely benefits a part of the nation at the expense of other groups. No civil servant can loyally serve all of his fellow citizens through a hard-nosed stance against deflation, and neither can he invoke the authority of economic science to buttress such a policy. But there is also another point of view that merits consideration and which is in fact decisive for our problem. It results from the fact that in practice, there are at any point in time two and only two fundamental options for monetary policy. The first option is to increase the quantity of paper money. The second option is not to increase the paper money supply. Now the question is how well each of these options harmonizes with the basic principles on which a free society is built. 5. How would money be produced in a free society? Let us first observe that the fact that the quantity of money is irrelevant for the wealth of a nation must not be confused with the ideal of stabilizing the quantity of money. The latter ideal is in fact a spurious ideal and does not follow from the aforementioned fact. There is nothing wrong with increases or decreases of the quantity of money. The point is that such increases or decreases should not be mistaken to benefit society as a whole. Right and wrong in monetary policy does not concern the question, to which end should the quantity of money be modified? Rather, it concerns the question, who has the right to modify the quantity of money? And in a free society, the obvious answer is, all producers of money have the right to produce more money, and all owners of money have the right to use their property as they see fit. In a truly free society, the production of money is a matter of private initiative. Money is produced and sold just like any other commodity or service. And this means in particular that in a free society, the production of money is competitive. It is a matter of mining precious metals and of minting coins. And both mining and minting are subject to the competition emanating from all other market participants. In selling his product, the money producer competes with all other people who own money and seek to buy the same goods that he desires. And in buying factors of production, the money producer competes with the producers of chairs, theater performances, telephones, carpets, cars, and so on. In a word, In a free society, the production of money is constrained within fairly narrow limits. Limits that are determined by the willingness of other members of society to cooperate with our money producer rather than with someone else. What kind of money would prevail in a free society? Theoretical considerations and historical experience all point to the same answer. A free society would use precious metals as money. Payments would be made in coins made out of gold, silver, platinum, copper, or whatever other substance would combine scarcity with the physical advantages of these metals. By contrast, paper money has always been fiat money. That is, it has always been imposed by the coercive power of the state. It is not the money of the free market, but the money of a partially enslaved society. 6. The production of money in a free society is a matter of free association. Everybody from the miners to the owners of the mines to the minters and up to the customers who buy the minted coins, all of them benefit from the production of money. None of them violates the property rights of anybody else because everybody is free to enter the mining and minting business and nobody is obliged to buy the product. Things are completely different once we turn to money production in interventionist regimes, which have prevailed in the West for the better part of the past 150 years. Here we need to mention in particular two institutional forms of monetary interventionism: fraudulent fractional reserve banking and fiat money. The common characteristic of both these institutions is that they violate the principle of free association. They enable the producers of paper money and of money titles to expand their production through the violation of other people's property rights. Banking is fraudulent whenever bankers sell uncovered or only partially covered money substitutes that they present as fully covered titles for money. These bankers sell more money substitutes than they could have sold if they had taken care to keep a 100% reserve for each substitute they issued. The producer of fiat money, in our days typically paper money, sells a product that cannot withstand the competition of free market monies, such as gold and silver coins, and which the market participants only use because the use of all other monies is severely restricted or even outlawed. The most eloquent illustration of this fact is that paper money in all countries has been protected through legal tender laws. Paper money is inherently fiat money. It cannot thrive but when it is imposed by the state. In both cases, the production of money is excessive because it is no longer constrained by the informed and voluntary association of the buying public. In a free market, paper money could not sustain the competition of the far superior metal monies. The production of any quantity of paper money is therefore excessive by the standards of a free society. Similarly, fractional reserve banking produces excessive quantities of money substitutes. At any rate, in those cases in which the customers are not informed that they are offered fractional reserve bank deposits rather than genuine money titles. The excessive production of money and money titles is inflation by the Rothbardian definition, which we have adapted at the present study to the case of paper money. Inflation is an unjustifiable redistribution of income in favor of those who receive the new money and money titles first, and to the detriment of those who receive them last. In practice, the redistribution always works out in favor of the fiat money producers themselves, who we misleadingly call central banks, and of their partners in the banking sector and at the stock exchange. And of course, inflation works out to the advantage of governments and their closest allies in the business world. Inflation is the vehicle through which these individuals and groups enrich themselves unjustifiably at the expense of the citizenry at large. If there is any truth to the socialist caricature of capitalism, an economic system that exploits the poor to the benefit of the rich, then this caricature holds true for a capitalist system strangulated by inflation. The relentless influx of paper money makes the wealthy and powerful richer and more powerful than they would be if they depended exclusively on the voluntary support of their fellow citizens. And because it shields the political and economic establishment of the country from the competition emanating from the rest of society, inflation puts a brake on social mobility. The rich stay rich longer, and the poor stay poor longer than they would in a free society. The famous economist Joseph Schumpeter once presented inflation as the harbinger of innovation. As he had it, inflationary issues of banknotes would serve to finance upstart entrepreneurs who had great ideas but lacked capital. Now, even if we abstract from the questionable ethical character of this proposal, which boils down to subsidizing any self-appointed innovator at the involuntary expense of all other members of society, we must say that in light of practical experience, Schumpeter's theme is wishful thinking. Credit expansion financed through printing money is in practice the very opposite of a way to combat the economic establishment. It is the preferred means of survival for an establishment that cannot or can no longer sustain the competition of its competitors. It would not be uncharitable to characterize inflation as a large-scale ripoff in favor of the politically well-connected few and to the detriment of the politically destitute masses. It always goes hand in hand with the concentration of political power in the hands of those who are privileged to own a banking license and of those who control the production of the monopoly paper money. It promotes endless debts, puts society at the mercy of monetary authorities such as central banks, and to that extent entails moral corruption of society. All right, so we are jumping into the last couple of sections here of this piece. So let's hit our sponsor real quick and come back and then close out deflation and liberty. 7. Inflation in the form of fractional reserve banking and fiat money is ultimately a self-defeating practice. It bears in itself the germs of its own destruction, and as we shall see, deflation is the essential vehicle of this destruction. We can distinguish three scenarios of the halt of inflationary processes. First, there can be a liquidity crisis of the fractional reserve banking system that ends up in a bank run, that is, in a sharp decline of the demand for money substitutes. The concomitant drastic reduction of the money supply entails a corresponding decrease of money prices, which negatively affects all market participants who have financed their operations through debt. The lower nominal selling receipts after the run do not suffice to pay back the debts contracted at the higher nominal price level of the past. This in turn jeopardizes the positions of many of the creditors, who when they do not get their money back, cannot pay back their creditors. Thus, the liquidity crisis of our fractional reserve banks entails a general financial meltdown. Rock bottom is reached in a commodity money system when all money substitutes have vanished and the market participants have turned to using the money commodity itself or use competing currencies, for example, other commodities or foreign paper monies. After the deflation has cleaned up the economic landscape, fractional reserve banking and other forms of financial intermediation will play a less significant role in the economy. Firms and individuals will, at the margin, turn to financing whatever purchases they make through personal savings. In short, financial decision-making will be even more conservative and more decentralized than before. The first scenario was very common in the 19th century and up to the Great Depression, which, according to Irving Fisher in the early Chicago School, was all about debt deflation entailed by a liquidity crisis of fractional reserve banking. The scenario became less important after the introduction of deposit insurance, which for all practical purposes established 100% reserve banking in the U.S. It could have some relevance, however, in explaining the more recent financial crises in Russia, Brazil, Argentina, and certain Asian countries, in particular if the currencies of those countries at the time of the crisis could be interpreted as money substitutes for U.S. dollars. Second, there can be intertemporal misallocations of resources when fraudulent fractional reserve banks increase the money supply and thereby depress market interest rates below their equilibrium level. Then entrepreneurs invest too many of the available resources high up in the physical production chain and not enough resources in the lower stages of the structure of production. The result becomes visible after some time when a more or less great number of firms must file bankruptcy. This in turn jeopardizes their creditors, in particular fractional reserve banks, and leads to the chain of events we described above. The difference between the second and the first scenario is in the causation of the bank run. In the former, the bank run starts more or less by accident, when one major market participant, be it out of negligence or due to unforeseen contingencies, fails and pulls down a house of cards. By contrast, in the scenario we are now considering, the bank run is the necessary consequence of a previous misallocation of resources that resulted from a fraudulent increase of the money supply. The question is whether this scenario applied to any historical crisis is somewhat controversial. Many Austrian economists believe it fits the Great Depression and several other economic crises of the past. At any rate, it is certainly a conceivable scenario, and it also involves a heavy dose of money substitute deflation. Hence, in this scenario too, inflation ends up in a deflationary meltdown of the old ways of finance. The share of banking and financial intermediation in overall economic activity will be reduced, and financial decision-making will be even more conservative and decentralized than it is anyway. The two foregoing scenarios both involve a more or less sudden decline of the demand for money substitutes, which entail a more or less rapid physical disappearance of these substitutes from circulation as market participants switch to using base money. By contrast, in the case of paper money, it is very unlikely that there will ever be a rapid deflation in our definition, a reduction of the money supply. The reason is that paper money is protected through legal tender laws and other legislation. That leaves barter as the only legal alternative to using paper money, and barter is so much less beneficial than monetary exchange that market participants typically prefer using even very inflationary monies rather than turning to barter. In all known cases, it was only under extreme duress when the purchasing power of their paper holdings dwindled within hours so that indirect exchange became impractical that the market participants finally ignored the laws and started using monies other than the legal tender. The foregoing three scenarios cover probably most historical cases in which inflation has been brought to an end. If we tie this up with our comparative analysis of free and compulsory production of money and money substitutes, we come to the conclusion that deflation is not a mere redistribution game that benefits some individuals and groups at the expense of other individuals and groups. Rather, deflation appears as a great harbinger of liberty. It stops inflation and destroys the institutions that produce inflation. It abolishes the advantage that inflation-based debt finance enjoys at the margin over savings-based equity finance. And it therefore decentralizes financial decision-making and makes banks, firms, and individuals more prudent and self-reliant than they would have been under inflation. Most importantly, deflation eradicates the rechanneling of incomes that result from the monopoly privileges of central banks. It thus destroys the economic basis of the false elites and obliges them to become true elites rather quickly or abdicate and make way for new entrepreneurs and other social leaders. It is highly significant that the authors of the 1931 Macmillan Report, which analyzed the worldwide financial crisis of the time, recognized and emphasized that deflation was foremost a political problem. They clearly saw that deflation brings down the politico-economic establishment, which thrives on inflation and debts, and that it therefore brings about some circulation of the elites. The late Lord Keynes and his co-authors, among them several leaders of the London banking industry and of the British cooperative and labor union movements, were of course convinced that their country could not do without them. Deflation puts a brake, at the very least a temporary brake, on the further concentration and consolidation of power in the hands of the federal government and in particular in the executive branch. It dampens the growth of the welfare state if it does not lead to its outright implosion. In short, deflation is at least potentially a great liberating force. It not only brings the inflated monetary system back to rock bottom, it brings the entire society back in touch with the real world because it destroys the economic basis of the social engineers, spin doctors, and brainwashers. In light of these considerations, deflation is not merely one fundamental policy option next to the fundamental alternative of reinflation. Rather, if our purpose is to maintain and, where necessary, to restore a free society, then deflation is the only acceptable monetary policy. The case of Japan might serve as a warning counterexample. The severe Japanese recession of the early 1990s was both an economic and a political threat to the establishment. In Japan, the process of consolidation and centralization of power started right after World War II, when the economic experts within the U.S., occupation forces, imposed Keynesian and socialist policies on their former enemy. By the late 1980s, the process had advanced to such an extent that it was politically impossible to allow deflation to cleanse the economy and politics. The Japanese governments of the 1990s sought to fix the economic crisis through increasingly heavy doses of inflation. But the only result of this policy was to give a zombie life to the hopelessly bureaucratic and bankrupt conglomerates that control Japanese industry, banking, and politics. After almost 15 years of mindless inflation, Japan's economic crisis had turned into a fundamental political crisis that sooner or later will bring the country onto the verge of revolution. This is also what will happen to the West if the citizens of our countries let their governments have a free hand in monetary affairs. 8. In conclusion, let us restate the main points. Deflation is far from being inherently bad. Quite to the contrary, it fulfills the very important social function of cleansing the economy and the body politic from all sorts of parasites that have thrived on the previous inflation. In a word, the dangers of deflation are chimerical, but its charms are very real. There is absolutely no reason to be concerned about the economic effects of deflation unless one equates the welfare of the nation with the welfare of its false elites. There are, by contrast, many reasons to be concerned about both the economic and political consequences of the only alternative to deflation, namely reinflation, which is, of course, nothing but inflation, pure and simple. The purpose of these pages is not to appeal to the reason of our monetary authorities. There is absolutely no hope that the Federal Reserve or any other fiat money producer of the world will change their policies anytime soon. But it is time that the Friends of Liberty change their minds on the crucial issue of deflation. False thinking on this point has given our governments undue leeway, of which they have made ample and bad use. Ultimately, we need to take control over the money supply out of the hands of our governments and make the production of money again subject to the principle of free association. The first step to endorsing and promoting this strategy is to realize that governments do not, indeed cannot, fulfill any positive role whatever through the control of our money. Love that last paragraph. Now, it has been a crazy long day, and I have been all over the place. And it is somewhere close to midnight right now, and I am finally finishing up today's recording. So I'm probably just going to publish this early tomorrow morning. But that finally concludes our amazing piece by Herg Guido Holzman, Deflation and Liberty. And he lays out this argument just wonderfully. And we are going to go, obviously it is a little bit too late for me to start digging into commentary on this one, but we are going to do this, we're going to jump into all of this in the next episode. I'm going to reiterate a lot of the main points and kind of explain with analogies a lot of what he's trying to get across here, because I know some of it probably was a little bit, you know, it gets really wordy sometimes and you just kind of zone out for like a couple of sentences. So I will try to boil this down to its key points, and then we're going to talk a lot about how exactly all the ways that deflation and a tool just like Bitcoin accomplishes this very task and is actually going to be an incredibly powerful force for liberty on a global scale, not just within a country. We are dealing with a very, very unique environment that Bitcoin has literally changed the game when we talk about this. And so I just really want to talk about like what a society with a deflationary money will look like, and all the reasons why we actually kind of already know. Bitcoin actually gives us a great example of how these things will play out. So it's going to be fun. We're going to dig into all of this, and it'll be a guy's take episode tomorrow. Well, tomorrow, according to the time that I'm recording this right now, because it is not quite midnight yet, but it will probably be this very same day if you're actually listening to this. I think I'm going to be publishing two episodes tomorrow because I want to get this out before the week is out. So thank you guys so much for listening. This concludes Deflation and Liberty by Herg Guido Holzman. And again, that was made available by the wonderful Mises Institute, which you can find on Mises.org. Dropping all of these links in the show notes so you can check it out. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss tomorrow's Guys Take episode, where we break all of this stuff down and really hit home this argument. And also, we have a lot of great stuff coming next week. I got a really awesome piece that we're going to be diving into that's going to take a number of episodes. And then also on Monday, we have Aaron Van Verdam's interview. We had a wonderful chat all about his writings, and he's just such an amazing writer, and I have been following him. He's the author of the State Chains article that we just recently read on this show. He does such a good job of breaking down the technical, explaining and figuring out exactly how all of these technical developments work. And I know there are a number of things that I would have had a very, very hard time understanding without him. So we have an absolute blast in that conversation. I think you guys are going to love it. So stay tuned for that. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter. I am at The Crypto Economy. This is Guy Swan. You're listening to the Crypto Economy Podcast. And this is where we read and explore all the crazy technology, the history, the philosophy behind this insane new world being built. And the one that is going to lead us into a very different and much brighter privacy-preserving sovereign future. So I hope you guys are excited about all of this stuff as I am. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to share this out with everybody you know in the Bitcoin and crypto economy space. I love you, and I will catch you on the next episode. Until then, take it easy, guys.